Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman. The largest marine monument in the world is in and around the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. How's the coral and the reef fish and the algae? We'll get an update from Atsuko Fukunaga, lead scientist of an expedition just back from Papahanaumokuakea. And what about Hawaii's economy? We'll get the latest on the state of the state's money outlook with Carl Bonham, executive director of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization. Also, student debt and the gender gap. There are more connections than you may think. We'll hear more from Joanna Armberger of the American Association of University Women. It's Tuesday, October 3rd, day 7 of our fall pledge drive. Those conversations and more right after the news. Hawaii, as you know, is home to unparalleled natural beauty covering land, sea, and sky. Some of the most magnificent treasures are outside the main Hawaiian Islands. That includes the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, which now covers more than 500,000 square miles. Our first guest this morning just returned from a 3.5-week trip to the monument, funded by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Atsuko Fukunaga is the lead scientist on that expedition and joins us live in our studio. Atsuko, good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For coming in. What was your biggest takeaway from the trip?
Well, we had a really good trip diving throughout the monument. We had 18 diving ops days, and we had a really good weather, so every single ops day we dove, and every single site, it's very beautiful. Especially, particularly my diving, I was greeted by a lot of big fish like lua and a large school of omilu, and, you know, the diversity of corals, and it was just amazing, and it's just really good to see how most of the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument is doing really well.
So that's one of your takeaways, is that it's a positive situation there. I understand that you have different teams to study different aspects, and part of that is this long-term monitoring.
Correct.
Explain that a bit.
So we have two teams serving for fish and benthics, which is corals and some of those anemones, things like that. And this survey has been going on since 2000. Mm-hmm. So it's been 17 years of time series. Basically, we use standardized methods so we can compare our data from year to year just to make sure that everything is going well up there. There's no like a huge effect of effects on like a coral health, fish populations.
You were saying an interesting thing earlier, though, that it depending on where you looked, you saw different situations.
Correct.
With the coral.
Yeah, so it's especially particularly shallow sites. Mm-hmm. When we go to like a 10 feet of water, 15 feet of water, the water tends to be warmer, and we'll see like some corals bleached. It's very species specific, so we have like one species of coral doing really well, and right next to it, there's a colony that's bleached and different species. So yeah, it's and then like we go to the next site, like say like we are diving on one side of like let's say Laysan Island, and then now we go to the south side of like Laysan Island, the same island, and then we'll see like the most amazing coral reefs, like all healthy, doing really well. So yeah, it's really interesting, like how like a little distance we make using a small boat, and then we jump in, and like it's completely different site.
Now, this was your second diving trip out there. Out of various things that you saw, what did you have any surprises? Anything surprise you this time around?
Actually, I was really surprised that the amount of sharks we did not see. So last year we actually ran into a huge school of sharks, like especially Galapagos sharks. And this year I was sort of expecting to see something like that, and then like it just never happened. And all the sharks we saw were like very small. And
Is there anything to be read into that?
Or? No. We actually had a team. We had a team doing a camera survey, specifically targeting sharks, and then they were recording good-sized sharks, and then they saw some tiger sharks. And so I don't think it's just this year they decided not to show up. But then it was kind of funny. We saw a lot of Ulua at almost every single site we dove. We were greeted by at least a few Ulua.
Fun for you. Yeah. I'm not sure how that does on the scientific research part, but that would be fun. Are there any parts of expeditions like this, work like you do on a regular basis, that you feel that people generally don't understand perhaps or have a bit of a feel for? Help us get a bit of a feel for what's important about this work.
Well, it's just so isolated. It's just really hard to get to, first of all. And it's just the first day we actually have to travel more than one day to actually get to the monument. Mm. And the first stop, like Wrench Frigate Shoal, it's just so far away and so isolated. And it's a really good place for us to study when there's no human impact, like when there are no people around. Yes. What's going to happen to the ecosystem? And it's an amazing opportunity for scientists to actually see that and being able to share the findings when we come back.
And that idea of building a scientific record in terms of going back to the same places over time and being able to establish a baseline and then detect changes from that, I imagine that's got to be pretty important.
Yes.
In terms of a forward looking. And then when you come back and analyze data from the trip that you just made and looking ahead to your next trip, are there ideas or insights that you got from your experience this time around that will help inform your further research?
Yes. Actually, this year was the first time we tried to incorporate some benthic, like a habitat information, along with the fish survey. So we always have fish and benthic team looking at the fish and habitat, but those teams go to different sites. So this is actually the first year to have both fish and habitat information from the same site. And I'm looking forward to analyze that data and see what sort of habitat features are associated with, like, what fish. So we will know when, like, certain habitat features degrade at certain site, we may lose certain species of fish from there.
But that ability to almost develop sort of an earlier warning system.
Yes.
And the light is turning yellow before the light turns red.
Correct, yeah. So we have sort of like a predictive power with that data, hopefully. And we may be able to apply it to like a main Hawaiian island. Like we can use that data for management and some improvement, things like that. So
you mentioned that you felt fortunate in terms of the weather because the seas were relatively calm.
Correct.
Again, people may not think about this, but you're in gear, you're down there. This is field work, is scuba diving, and that makes a real difference.
Yes, it definitely makes a huge difference. It's just in terms of physical stress. Actually, this morning I went to my swimming practice and realized, I looked at my legs and realized, like, I didn't really have any bruises. It's just like a huge difference from like last year. I came back and it's like all bruised up. And it's like, oh, I don't have any bruise.
Well, we're glad you're healthy, and we wish you continued success in your work as well. And thanks for sharing that with us. Atsuko Fukunaga, an ecological research statistician at Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument. She was the lead scientist on a recent 3.5-week expedition to the monument funded by NOAA. We'll be right back.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
This is The Conversation. Growth in the state's economy is slowing down. That's the view of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization, which has just updated its economic forecast for the state. Carl Bonham is UHERO's executive director. He sat down with me earlier to talk about where Hawaii's economy is right now.
We're operating at a very high level of employment, very low unemployment rates. The tourism industry is sort of firing on all cylinders. Overall, a good place to be. Really completely recovered, if you will, from the Great Recession. So one indicator of that is the broad measures of unemployment that count the people who have sort of given up looking and have left the labor force. That measure of unemployment is back down to where it was before the Great Recession. That was an issue over the last several years, is that mm-hmm. was still elevated. So a lot of signs that things are much, much better, but probably well past the peak growth rates during this cycle. A very healthy economy facing some slowing. And if the economy slows down significantly, if you only grow jobs or income at about 1%, it sort of starts to look a little fragile in the sense that it doesn't take much of a push from the wrong direction, if you will, to sort of tip you into no growth at all.
Right. You mentioned the tightening labor market. How does that spill over or move over into wage growth? And what do you see in terms of that?
Well, so that's, you know, that's really the key both in Hawaii and nationally. Mm. And the wage growth has not been as strong as you would expect or would like to see. This is the conundrum, the real question that the Federal Reserve has been facing for the last several years is, you know, we keep looking at the employment numbers and saying, you know, we're really pretty darn close to full employment if we're not already there.
Right.
And so we really should be seeing wage growth and upward pressure on inflation.
Right.
And we have seen some of that in Hawaii. In 2015, 2016, we saw a pretty rapid growth in household income as measured by the census. In some sectors, we saw pretty good wage growth, and per capita income grew more strongly than it has in the rest of this cycle. Still not quite as fast as you would have seen in previous cycles. And so one of the stories behind this nationally, and we don't necessarily have the data in Hawaii to dig into this, but is lower productivity growth. Mm. So you can have, if workers aren't actually a lot more productive, partly because we haven't invested in everything from infrastructure to education to more capital on the private sector side, then you won't necessarily see the same kind of wage growth that you would have seen in the past and right. what is consistent with the models. And so we've seen some, just not as much as we would like to see.
Right. Construction, you mentioned, and you've been fairly consistent. You guys have been watching this over time, yeah. expecting the leveling off, seeing the leveling off. You mentioned sort of past its peak at this point, yes?
And, I mean, forecasting construction is very challenging. It's probably not quite as hard as the stock market or foreign currencies, but, you know, it's very volatile.
Yes.
And the big projects can swing the numbers pretty dramatically
sure.
from year to year, just depending on when they happen. I mean, you know, if they shift by 1 month,
right.
You can get big swings. And, you know, what we've seen is, you know, we had a flurry of activity mm-hmm. really in 14, 15 and into 16. Around Ala Moana and Kaka'ako, mm-hmm. you had renovations in Waikiki with mm-hmm. the International Marketplace and several resort properties being renovated and even new like the Ritz-Carlton, new products going up. And what we don't have a sort of full channel of replacement for that level of activity.
Sure.
And so we've sort of ratcheted down just a little bit from this peak. But there's a lot of stuff that is being talked about or has already been applied for permits that looks like we're going to be able to carry on for an extended period of time. And we need construction, particularly in housing, right? Mm-hmm. There's a serious need for additional housing. And so as long as the economy sort of keeps humming along, even if it's only at 1% or 0.75% growth in jobs and 1.5% growth in income, so long as that just sort of keeps moving along, we think the construction activity will continue. And that'll be a very different story than you typically see with construction, where you tend to see boom bust.
Right.
And the thing that I think is really different about where we are today is we don't have that large influx of outside money rushing in, whether it's from subprime lending and second home buying or go back to Japanese bubble. We haven't seen that yet. And, you know, that's probably a good thing. So the outlook is a fairly high level of continued activity, just not the same kind of growth rates we've seen in the past.
Tourism. You mentioned kind of surprising that we've seen, again, records and continuing records. Some talk also from some folks questioning that capacity is a big word, but at least reaching levels of potential discomfort for some people, some areas, some situations. When you take a longer view of tourism within Hawaii's economy, what do you see?
You don't see a lot of growth. We're really challenged with the new environment in the industry where we simply have really poor data on how many rental units are available, right? I mean, we have a pretty decent count of the number of hotel rooms and the number of timeshares and
flights.
And certainly flights and bodies. But you don't have a real – and this is part of why we've been surprised in the last year or so, is that we're looking at sort of traditional measures of capacity, and you're in an environment where that – you know, what defines a vacation unit is changing. And so, a lot of where the industry goes will have to do with what is a vacation unit and what happens legally to those – are we going to see restrictions on those because of some discomfort in some neighborhoods, maybe a lot of discomfort in some neighborhoods, and really no action from policymakers?
Right.
I mean, we wrote a blog post about this, I guess about January of last year, how many tourists is too many? And we wrote another one on home share vacation units and the need to have policy to address what we want to allow to happen and then to collect the tax revenues off of that.
Right, exactly.
And so the long-term picture for tourism in terms of number of bodies in particular is very directly tied to where you're going to put them, where are they going to stay, and what the community is going to allow to happen. And so in most of our longer-term forecast, it's much, much slower growth.
Just to close out, when you look out over the horizon, and not that anything keeps you up at night, but what would concern you in terms of Hawaii's economy?
Well, usually this has been true at least since the Great Recession, and really further back than that. Our biggest risks are ourselves, and I don't just mean the residents of Hawaii, but the policymakers in the state, at the county, and at the national level. And if you look at events, everything from the Great Recession, which was very much a policy-induced crisis that didn't have to happen. And, we have the ability to really mess things up.
Do we have the ability to resolve them?
I think we do. And hopefully we will make the right choices and we won't mess up in the same ways.
Yes. On that note, we'll have you back in the future, I'm sure. Carl Bonham is the Executive Director of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization. Thanks, as always, for coming by.
Thanks, Bill.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
We move on to a serious issue here on The Conversation: understaffed, underfunded, and facing a crisis of care. That describes the situation when it comes to the state of mental health care in Hawaii's prisons. Civil Beat reporter Lue Kanea has been working on a devastating piece on that topic and joins us now. Lue, your reporting shows a situation of chronic understaffing, a disturbing lack of care. Where does the story begin?
Well, the story goes all the way back to 2008 when the U.S. Justice Department came to basically tell the state to fix the situation. At the time, it was really horrific. We went through the process of almost 7 years to go through and fix the situation in jails and prisons here. And they finally, ended a settlement agreement with the Justice Department. You know, they were satisfied that the level of care was going up well enough to satisfy their demand. And that was back in June 2015. And my reporting basically takes off from there. And the situation has pretty much went downhill after that. Some of the standards that the Justice Department established, they're just not even meeting them anymore. That's kind of just of what I found in my story.
You also lay out some very specific numbers. For example, the Department of Public Safety, the mental health branch, has 61 budgeted positions, but 25 of them, 40%, vacant as of Friday. OCCC, 12 of 34 budgeted positions not filled, and those numbers go even higher in other situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much at the heart of what's going on. You know, if you have that kind of vacancy in the positions, then obviously the quality of care would obviously plummet, and that's pretty much what I found there. And so they are basically underfunded to the point where, or at least that they're in budget crunch, even though we are only a few months into the fiscal year. They have stopped using overtime, or at least banned the use of overtime among the mental health staff. So that means basically they don't have enough people to cover the weekends and on holidays. So they're not doing the rounds on the weekends for the people who are on a suicide watch, for example, which is by department policy they should be doing every day.
And this funding issue is not something that lies at the feet of the legislature, apparently, because funding has been approved, again, in terms of you trace through this in your reporting on the story.
Right. I'm still doing some reporting around that issue. I haven't quite gotten the full explanation as to where the money went and what was used for. But basically, the legislature have given the department enough funding to fill those positions. You know, the number that you mentioned, the overall mental health branch should have 61 people working for them, but 40% are missing, right? But the money has been spent, and apparently they're in a budget crunch right now for some reason, even though they don't have that many people in that branch. So I'm going to follow up with another story coming up that will take I look at that stuff.
And we will look for that. And meanwhile, civilbeat.org for an outstanding piece titled The Disturbing State of Mental Health Care in Hawaii's Prisons, written by Lue Kanea. And Lue, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Women in the workplace make less than men. That's not exactly a new situation. In Hawaii, women make an estimated 83 cents for each dollar a white male makes. The gender gap isn't going away anytime soon, and it's especially dramatic in the area of student debt. A local branch of the American Association of University Women has just released a report called Deeper in Debt: Women and Student Loans. My colleague Chris Vandercook recently spoke about it with AAUW Honolulu President Joanna Armberger.
When it comes to college debt, you know, this is an issue that many Americans are becoming more and more aware of as a real crisis across the country.
Sure.
And AUW's latest research really looks at how the student debt crisis impacts women at a greater proportion than it does their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the student population, the good news is women represent 56% of enrolled college students. But when we look at the debt that they hold about two-thirds of the outstanding student debt. So mm-hmm. that's a much bigger number than their representation at school would indicate. And it takes women longer to pay off their student loans. And part of that is because of the pay gap that you mentioned earlier. So mm-hmm. We have a lot of research going back many years about the pay gap that women face. And so lucky we live in Hawaii, the pay gap's 83%. Compared to their male counterparts. And some of those numbers, both in terms of student debt statistics and also pay gap numbers, are worse for women of color. And so we really see Pacific Islander and Native Hawaiian women facing an even steeper pay gap.
What kind of percentages do they run into?
I believe it's about 64%. So it's and we have the research online that you can look up, but it's it's a dramatic difference in terms of the pay gap. And then we also, in this research report, we take a look at how women of color also experience student debt differently. And some of it is how much debt they're taking out. So women tend to take out more debt than men do.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that African-American women take out the highest levels of student debt. And so they also then, combined with that pay gap issue we were talking about, take even longer to pay it off.
When you say that Hawaii at 83% is better off than some states, how bad does it get?
Well, nationwide, we're at 80%. Mm-hmm. So there are some states that are dramatically lower than that, but the nationwide average is 80%. So we've got a little 3% bump here in the state of Hawaii. But also when you think about the high cost of living, it can make it challenging for women to make a dent, get ahead.
What can we do about this?
Well, the problem is complex, so the solutions are also going to be equally complex or multifaceted. So there's no single answer to this problem. One of the things that we can do is ask whether or not states are able to take a greater role in providing education. So when we look at the trends of student debt in America, we see that the student debt increase really started to go much higher when states started pulling back on their support for their public institutions. So mm-hmm. students are being asked to pay a greater share of that burden, and student expenses have been rising faster than inflation. So healthcare and tuition are our fastest inflating expenses in the economy. So that would be one thing. I would also say, you know, Pell Grants are one of the federal programs that provides need-based funding for students, and that program has been under attack. And so that's something that we encourage to provide funding, continued funding and support of that Pell Grant program.
What is a Pell Grant?
So the Pell Grant is one of the, it's a grant that is offered by the federal government to pay for student loan or to pay for student expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a grant, not a scholarship. So there are a variety of different scholarships that the federal government subsidizes along with the Pell Grant. And the scholarships, the loans do have to be paid back. And so you have student and parent loans that students can apply for, and those are generally need-based. And then students can also get private loans, and private loans are often higher interest rates than the federally subsidized programs. And that would be another recommendation we have, is that oftentimes student debt can follow students for lifetime, because
yeah.
you can't discharge student debt in bankruptcy.
Right.
And so one of our recommendations is to consider making especially private loans dischargeable in bankruptcy, so that in those cases where students are unable to pay it back, that they can get out from under that.
Lending institutions aren't particularly eager to
no.
issue loans that they're not going to get back.
Right. That's not a popular solution. So again, I would say increased support for federally subsidized loans that are guaranteed by the federal government, and they also have much lower interest rates, would be part of the solution. And then also having income-driven repayment plans is another way to help with repayment issues that students face. And not the rule. There are many different programs that are out there in terms of different loan programs. So not all students can get these income-dependent repayment plans.
Yeah. Well, under the current federal climate, do you see the federal government, you know, in the near to long term, wanting to help out in this area?
That's a very difficult question. I think the states are really going to be the ones taking the lead in the near term, mm-hmm. And I think we see a variety of states taking those initiatives up, and even in Hawaii, we've looked at that in terms of making community colleges accessible for people that don't have other financing sources. So I think that many of the issues do need to be dealt with from the federal level, but I also think that states can take a leading role in many of the solutions.
It would seem a little bit unrealistic to look for help from the feds.
Right. I'm not sure if Congress could legislate itself out of a paper bag right now, so I think we need to look to our states that are more functional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also wondering if the whole paradigm of the necessity of a college education isn't changing.
Do you mean in terms of whether or not people...
Whether it really sets you up for a career as much as it's cracked up to be.
Right. Well, I mean, to a certain extent, having a college degree is almost to the point of maybe a generation ago, a high school degree was expected as your kind of entry point. But I think when we look at the economy, we do see shortages in the trades. I think many high schools and communities have moved away from educating in the trades. And so we're seeing a shortage of those skilled trades that can also provide well-paying jobs for people. So I do think that college is not right for everybody, but we do need to have programs that ensure that people can get the education that they do need to be able to participate in the modern workforce.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But we're also seeing a glut of people in professions that require a college education, and you come out of law school and find out that you're an intern.
Correct. But again, like I said, some of the trades we're seeing shortages on, like welders and plumbers. So if we encourage people to consider what's best suited for them, I think that would be a way to diversify our economic base.
Is that part of the hope for the future, to the degree that there is hope for the future?
I would say I'm always hopeful for the future, and more and more states are coming to recognize that these kinds of issues need to be dealt with, along with the debt issues as well.
Joanna Amberger is president of AAUW Honolulu, the local branch of the American Association of University Women, which is presenting its report called Deeper in Debt, Women and Student Loans. That takes place tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Neil Blaisdell Center's Hawaii Suites. It's free, open to the public. You can find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation. That is The Conversation for today. Now we go back to Pledge Central with Noe Tanigawa and Ray Cruz.